I'm Pam Houston, and I'm a writer of fiction and nonfiction. I've written 5 books, 2 novels, 2 collections of short stories, and a book of essays, working on a memoir right now. I teach creative writing at UC Davis and in the Pacific University Low Residency Program.
How did you even become a writer? You who now teaches it, what's your first memory of writing?
Well, I actually probably wrote before my first memory. I was an only child of older parents who weren't really meant to be parents. And so I spent a great deal of time with my wonderful babysitter / godmother named Martha Washington, who taught me to read when I was 2 1/2. Mm-hmm. And when I was in kindergarten, they would take me out of kindergarten to read to the 3rd graders. I was just a little bookish kid, you know. Yeah. I was always reading. And I think I was always writing. I don't honestly remember a time that I wasn't writing. So I think even as a little kid, I would write stories and draw pictures and make comic strips and all the things that all kids do.
But what about telling stories?
Well, now that's one thing I can say for my parents. They were both great storytellers. My father had fantastic comic timing, like most people from New Jersey. And and my mom was an actress and kind of a show person. You know, she could hold a room.
Yeah.
So I think probably some of what I have comes from growing up in that household, though they weren't readers nor writers at all. We didn't have books in our house.
Yeah.
Valley of the Dolls. People always say, what books were in your house as a kid? It's the only one I remember. There were only like 5, and that was one of them. But they were great storytellers, especially my dad. He had that East Coast kind of, going to go down to the shore and go to the bar and tell, you know, just strike up a conversation.
Yeah. So
there was also a guy in our neighborhood where I grew up who took all the neighborhood kids camping. His name was Colonel Bob Miller. And he was a great storyteller. And I don't remember one story in particular.
Campfire stories? Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And that was kind of, he gave me my love of the outdoors, really, too.
Yeah.
So I mean, when I think about my childhood, I think, you know, storytellers all over the place, really. Even though I didn't come from a big family, you know, it wasn't that sort of thing. But all the people closest to me were good storytellers. And Martha herself, Martha Washington, my fairy godmother, she had been a supply sergeant in the Army, and she had lived on 4 continents, and she was a tough old girl, you know, and she could tell a story, too.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Is there ever a story or a book that really comes to mind?
Definitely The Secret Garden was a big one for me. All right, well, from when I was a kid, there was a Dr. Seuss, a kind of little or lesser-known Dr. Seuss book called On Beyond Zebra. Do you know that one?
No.
Well, there was an alphabet after Z, a whole nother 26 letters.
No kidding me.
It's a cool book, and a lot of people don't know it, but it was my favorite Dr. Seuss book. And every letter was shaped in this really extravagant way.
Yeah.
And it had a particular creature, you know, Seussian creature that started with that letter. So it's called On Beyond Zebra, 26 letters, 26 creatures.
Wonderful.
And that one, I think, mattered, you know, in a kind of an imaginative way.
That's fun.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah. But I did read a ton, and I discovered the modernists pretty early, and I fell in love with the modernists really early, like Hemingway and Virginia Woolf. And,
right. How about Steinbeck?
Steinbeck, yes. D.H. Lawrence.
Oh, yeah.
James Joyce. I read Portrait of the Artist very young. like so young now, I think, what did I think it all meant? But I must have had some idea, you know.
At some point, you started to write stories probably for a newspaper, school newspaper, or for your own purposes at home?
I think for my own purposes. I wrote like my friends and I would write. We went to see the film Cabaret.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like in, I don't know, seventh grade or sixth.
Right.
And then we went home and rewrote it and performed it in the basement. Cool. You know, it was always along those lines. I took all the creative writing classes in high school, which was fine. And then I went to the most loving, generous undergrad program in the country, maybe at the time, at Denison University, where all the professors wore ceramic peace signs around their neck. And going from my angry little household and my giant public high school to Denison was like never, never land. You know, like here were these old hippies who loved words and believed you could do anything you wanted with your life if you kept the greater good in mind and worked hard, you know?
Yeah.
And that wasn't how I was raised. I was raised in a household where my father said, you spend your whole life laying in the gutter with somebody else's foot on your neck. So it was a total 180, you know?
The hard, cold, cruel world is what my father called it.
Totally. So I went to Denison, and here were these people who had, you know, parties where we all howled at the moon, and parties where we read for hours Finnegan's Wake out loud and did shots of Jameson's Irish whiskey. It was heaven, you know, for a kid like me. It was like, oh, these are my people. So that was fantastic, but I didn't try to publish. I just wrote. And then I went to grad school, which was a little bit like back to my family. It was tough love. It was tough. And my
slap, wake up.
My work wasn't, you know, liked compared to some other people. I was not loved in grad school. I did not go to grad school, and everyone was like, you're a star.
Yeah.
But that is where I got published first. And I would never have sent anything out, because my teachers were very negative about my work. I would have never sent anything out had we not had a writers' conference called Writers at Work, which the graduate students helped run. And it was there that my work first got noticed and talked about.
How cool.
Sort of in spite of my teacher's dismissal of it.
And that's when you grew 10 foot tall?
It was, yeah. That's when, actually, it might be worth telling the story, because it's a really good story. So it was my first year at Utah, and I was getting evaluated. Oh, I guess it was the It was the beginning of my second year at Utah, and I had all these evaluations from my first year at Utah that basically said Pam should find something else to do with her hands. I mean, it was, my work was soundly and roundly and widely disliked, which, you know, it wasn't very good. I mean, it wasn't very good, but it wasn't as bad as they made it sound comparatively. Anyway, so we started this conference. This guy named James Thomas, one of the good guys at Utah, he started this conference, Writers at Work, and it was just brand new, and there weren't very many writers' conferences, and we sort of didn't know what we were doing, but we had it up in Park City, which was super fun.
Yeah.
And one of the things all the volunteers got in exchange for their work on the conference was a 20-minute consultation with a visiting editor, agent, or writer. And because my work was always so trashed in workshop, I, of course, chose writers, because there was no way I was ready for agents or editors to see it. And so I put down three writers. I think Charlie Baxter was there that year, and maybe Dennis Johnson. And anyway, I went up to see who I'd been paired with, and they said, oh, sorry, everybody's plate was full. It just didn't work out. And so I was walking away, and I wasn't even mad. I mean, that's how Utah was for me. Like, I was like, oh, well, of course not, you know.
Because you're a horrible writer.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I didn't really mind. You know, I was young in my class, and I did think I had a lot to learn. And I believed, you know, my parents' idea about me, which was the same as these people's idea about me. Right. And Denison had been this lovely dream in the middle, you know. Like, it wasn't like I walked around unhappy. You know, I didn't. I was like, well, I've got a lot to learn. It was fine.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I was walking away thinking, oh, well, you know, oh, well. And this woman walks up to me and she says, you know, I just heard that lady be shitty to you. And if my plate's not full. And if you want me to read your story, I'll read it. And I didn't know who she was, but I said, sure, well, that'd be lovely. So I had a copy of the one good story that I had written. And it was, I mean, again, it wasn't very good. Well, that was Shannon Ravenel, who edited Best American Short Stories for all of the 80s.
Wow.
And who founded Algonquin, was at that moment founding Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
Lovely person. And she read my story, and she went crazy over it. And she showed it to everyone there, including Carol Huck Smith, who became my long-term editor at Norton. She wrote an email. I don't know if there was email. She wrote a letter, or she made a phone call to Liz Derensoff, who was a good friend of hers, who is still my agent to this day. Like, basically every single thing that happened to me happened because of
that chance encounter.
Shannon's just random act of kindness. I mean,
yeah.
Honestly, speaking of George Saunders and kindness, it, just like seeing this, she had no reason on earth to think she would like the story I gave her. You know, there was 160 people there, and, you know, probably 10% of them were good. You know, that's how writers' conferences are. And, but she just saw them dismiss me and wanted to do a nice thing. And honestly, like, I got my agent from that. I got my editor of 20 years from that.
Jeez.
I started to send out stories because suddenly I had someone who was interested in it.
And believed in you.
And believed in me. And not very long after that, I got my first publication in Crazy Horse, literary magazine, Crazy Horse. And then immediately after, another one in Cimarron. And because they're both C's, I always forget which was first. But I think Crazy Horse was the first acceptance, and possibly Cimarron came out first, but those two were the first two right together.
And did you carry it around the hallways of
no.
academia, going, see?
No, but they could tell by my bearing that things had changed a little. And I did eventually leave that program. I did all the coursework and wrote my dissertation, which was Cowboys Are My Weakness. But it was a fairly dysfunctional program at that time, and I had watched two of my good friends fail for what I thought were not good reasons. And so I just was like, you know what? Writers are more fun than these people. And the fact that I'm back in academia is like the world's greatest joke, because when I made that decision to walk out, and I did walk out about 4 months before I was done, I thought, well, I'm making a big decision here. I'm saying I'm not going to be an academic. I'm going to be a writer.
Right.
I'm going to take the more risky path. You know, I had a book out and it was doing really well.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you're going to have a career for the rest of your life. So I thought I was making a big decision against academia then. And now here I am, a full professor. A full professor running a program and the best educated BA in America. My first book came out in 92 when I was still a grad student. And yeah, it was kind of weird what happened. You know, it was like the people who were threatened acted that way, and the people who weren't were happy for me. And but it was a weird place to be when it came out. But and then it did so much better than my wildest expectation. Like, I thought just getting it published was the thing. Like, I didn't even understand them. Like, I thought I was already done thinking there could be a good outcome and a bad outcome. I thought that part was past.
Yeah.
You know, it was a little book of short stories about rafting and sheep hunting and things that I didn't think anyone would care. You know, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
To me, getting the book published and getting it published at Norton was so much more than I ever thought would happen to me that I didn't even think about whether or not it would sell.
Yeah.
And so when it started to sell, I didn't even understand it. Like, I didn't even understand what was happening.
Yeah.
And Carol Smith, who was one of the greatest editors of all time and edited so many wonderful writers, many of whom you know, discovered Rick Bass and Andrea Barrett and worked with Jerry Stern and just on and on. I mean, so many writers. She was at that original conference, you know, in Park City. That's where we met. And she completely nursed me through that first book. It was as much her book as my book by the time it came out. She really stayed, like, every night on that tour, and the tour kept getting longer and longer and longer because the book was selling, and every night she wanted me to call her no matter what time it was. So even if I was in Seattle and I got back to my room at 11, she wanted to call me, she wanted me to call her in New York where it was 2, yeah, you right. know, and tell her how the evening went. And I miss her so much. It was a wonderful time. It was a wonderful time for a young person, and to have her, the night that my paperback rights sold, I was in Seattle on tour, and I called her, and she said, well, we had the paperback auction today, and I didn't even know what that was.
Right, right.
I had no expectation, because right. I didn't know what it was. And I was in grad school, so here I am on this tour, and I'm supposed to be, like, paying for stuff, you know, that they're going to reimburse me for, like, in 2 months.
Right.
But I'm making $4,400 a year,
right.
and I have this American Express card that I, you know, smartly applied for right. on my 18th birthday,
right.
but I have no way to pay it,
yeah.
you know, and I'm in hotels where a cup of coffee costs $8.
Right.
So I'm trying to, like, negotiate all this. So anyway, she said, we had the paperback auction today, and I said, oh, you know, and she said, now I want you to go to the mini bar and get out the champagne. And I'm thinking, not in a million billion years am I going to get a bottle
piece.
Of, oh, it's probably a $22 yeah. half,
yeah.
you know. And I don't even like champagne. And she's like, no, I want to hear the cork pop, you know. So I'm like, you know, like. And so I convince her that I've got the champagne open, which I don't. And she says, well, we sold the paperback rights, and it was a lot of money. It was $125,000, which I just say so that no one will think it was $6 million
right,
or anything.
Right, right.
But it was certainly more money than I had ever imagined, because I was at the time making $4,400 a year.
Yeah.
And she said, and I didn't, of course, even, I couldn't even picture 120.
Right, yeah. How many decimals is that?
Exactly. And, you know, I had a, like, my most valuable possession at the time was a North Face VE24 tent, you know? And the next day when I talked to my agent and she told me the same number, she said, don't spend it all on hiking boots. I mean, that's what they thought of me. Like, they thought I would go out and buy, like, 100,000.
Right.
Anyway, so I, none of it made any sense to me. But anyway, Carol said, you know what this means, don't you? And I said, no. And she said, it means that if you want to, you can be a writer for the rest of your life.
Whoa.
That was at about 2 in the morning, New York time.
Yeah.
I was in Seattle.
Were you able to go to sleep after that?
I don't remember. That was probably my favorite moment with Carol of all.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And then we did 4 more books together. No, we did 3 more books together. And after that. And then she passed away. Because she was old even then. She lived a good, wonderful life.
During that stage in your life, and you're continuing to write, did you have any habits about your writing? Did you? Some writers we talk to have these wonderful, delightful, idiosyncratic moments or superstitious behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
In your writing, did you develop any of those?
Probably. I mean, I always think that I don't have habits, and I'm not a regular writer at all. I'm sort of a binge writer, you know.
Yeah.
I don't hold myself to any sort of set the alarm for 5 and write every day. I never have.
Great.
There
are those who do.
Baudelaire. I know.
Baudelaire wrote 6 months out of the year, and the other 6 months he stayed drunk.
Uh-huh. That makes a certain. I mean,
like
I don't drink, but that makes a certain kind of sense to me. You know. That makes sense. But so I'm not very regular. But I'm sure that I have a million superstitions that work in.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm not sure I'd even know how to articulate them, you know? It's something about I have all these ideas of geometric shapes in my mind. So you ask a question, you're going to get an answer. And so whatever I'm working on, I think of it as a series of possible geometric shapes, like a Rubik's Cube or a spirograph flower.
Do they have color?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Or a Venn diagram.
I do that, too. I've never heard anybody else talk about that.
In fact, Venn diagrams really help me.
Yeah.
Or imagining it as a Venn diagram. But I'm always trying to imagine it as a very physical thing. And that thing can change as I move through the piece.
Wow.
Or there can be two or three things, like two or three different ways of looking at it. Like, is this a spirograph flower or is this a Venn diagram? And so that kind of thinking, used to scare me, because I used to believe I couldn't do it without it. And what if I couldn't do it? Something like that. That's not true anymore. Now I just think, oh, this is my weird tool. This is just what I do. And any book of mine, you know, I could tell you 10 different physical sort of graphs, sort of mathematical, geometrical ideas I had as a way to approach it and to keep approaching it day after day.
That's incredibly cool.
So if I got to a place, say, in Contents May Have Shifted, which is definitely a Rubik's Cube, and I was afraid I would be stuck, instead of thinking, oh, what is the story about or what is my character going to do, I would say, well, what if it's not a Rubik's Cube? What if it's a slinky that's attached to itself? And then the next morning, I would come in with the slinky, and that would be my way in.
Have you, you've worked with hundreds of students. Have you ever met another student whose thought processes were similar to that?
Not precisely. You know, it's a little like, what is that? You know, where the color has a number and... What's that called? Synesthesia.
Right.
It's a tiny bit like synesthesia, although I'm not synesthetic. Like when I have two of my students who are actually coming today are both synesthetic, and they will have the most hilarious conversations where one will go, oh, well, a 2 can't sit next to a 7 because it's blue, you know, and they know the same things about how the way 2s are blues and can't sit next to 7s. Like, it's not particular. Mine feels very particular to me.
Yeah.
But who knows? Maybe it's not, you know? I mean, I'd like to believe in some sort of collective, creative unconscious up there that might hold these things, you know? But so I guess that's it for me. Like, it's not exactly a superstition. It's like a particular approach.
So when you write, do you also do any doodles in the margin? No? Okay.
I do it all in my head. But when I see certain things, like my father left me just a little bit of money, and so for that reason, I have a little bit of money in stocks, and I don't, like, that was so his world that I don't go anywhere near it, but I'm afraid to touch it, so I just let it sit there, and I get these beautiful pieces of paper from the accountant with all these pies that are all these different colors. And so I, like, just this morning when I was cleaning up, I got my pies and I was like, is that my new short story? You know, honestly, like, so I will recognize it in the world, but I won't, I don't draw.
Yeah.
I'm aware of it as a figure that's helping me, and I will tend to see it in the world.
Yeah. That's incredibly cool. Now, you grew up at the time of early word processors and computers. Do you write longhand? Do you write on computer? Do you write little slips of paper that you go crazy trying to find later on?
Yes, all of those.
Yeah.
I also write in my phone, you know, in my notes function.
And do you keep journals?
No, never been a journaler.
Yeah.
No, never been. I mean, I guess when I was a kid, I did. You know, I kept something you might call a journal.
Yeah.
I gave up on journals when it became a verb. everybody started to talk about journaling.
Right.
And that kind of, I don't know, gerunds, I don't, they kind of turn my stomach. But I do keep notes. I keep notes, not, I mean, for me, the difference between a journal and what I do or what I think most writers do is that journals are bad writing. know? Like, yeah. they're all that stuff you shouldn't put in, right? I mean, that's how I think of journals. Because when I wrote them, I was 13, and I would write and write and write about how mad I was at my mother, or how mad I was at my boyfriend, or, you know, how lonely I was and how no one understood me, or all the stuff that 13-year-olds write. And so for me, that word journal is attached to that, which is why it kind of gives me the creeps. But for me, you know, I keep notes, which you could call a journal. So I have a thought, or I see a thing, or I smell a smell, or I hear something funny, or somebody says something hilarious in the ladies' room. You know, I write all that stuff down. Yeah. It's not a journal because I don't feel personally connected to it, except that I noticed it. You know, so I mean, I do feel personally connected to it, but, you know, it's not like, it's not me working out my own psychology, which is what I think. Well, of course, it is me working out my own psychology, but in a very sideways way.
Yeah.
Through metaphor, through the things I notice. I keep a journal of the things I notice, and I just don't call it a journal.
Do you see any major cataclysmic changes ahead for writing, storytelling, publishing that make you worried or get you excited?
No.
Okay, then moving on to the next question.
No, you know, I don't. I mean, obviously there's lots of changes in the publishing industry, none of which I understand, except that now it's going to be called Random Penguin, which is hilarious. I don't understand any of that, and I sort of make it a point not to find out. I don't want to know, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't write to get published in the first place. I wrote to save my own life. And so there'll be something. I mean, I'm 51. You know, it's not going to be that drastic while I'm still here, I don't think. You know, I got on Facebook because they told me to, and now I kind of like it because everybody likes my animals. But I don't, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, and I just try not to worry about it, because to me it never had to do with that. Like, it never really even had to do with getting published, though I am so grateful I did, and so grateful that I've been able to make my life this way. That's never why I wrote. And I'm always shocked when I meet someone for whom that is why they write, because I believe that any real writer doesn't write for that reason. And I could name
Kafka,
50 of my friends, you know, who would say, well, no, of course I don't write to get published. And it would be true. But our students who are trying to get published don't believe us when we say that.
Yeah, right. That's easy for you to say.
That's right. And that's what I always say. I say, I know that's easy for me to say, but it's true. So I'm not, like, I figure, like, other people will work that stuff out.
Yeah. Okay. Young aspiring writer comes up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have some promise. You've already looked at some stuff. What kind of advice do you give them, in a nutshell, besides take my class or enroll in an MFA program?
Honestly, it's really personal to them. You know, I have a few generic pieces of advice I give. I give Henry James advice. A writer should strive to be a person on whom nothing is lost. Pay attention. You know, pay attention every minute, every second. I think that's really good advice for anyone.
Yeah.
But it really depends on the person. You know, I work really closely, because I work mostly with grad students, I work really closely with individuals. And, you know, for one individual, it would be handing them white noise. Mm-hmm. And for another individual, it would be, say, yeah, take that fire lookout job. And for another individual, it would say, well, that's great that your husband left you, you know, more time for your writing. Yeah. Like, you know, teaching and mentoring in the way I do it is it's a very personal thing. And
very cool.
And it's not, there are things I believe. You know, like, you have to pay attention, and you have to be willing to, you know, put the blood on the wall. And, you know, there are generic things I believe about rigor and compassion and things that I would say to any writer. But really, the teaching and mentoring process is about what that writer needs to hear.
That's neat. That's wonderful.
Do you have any particular favorite writers now in your life?
Oh, yes. So many. I have lots of favorite writers.
Does that mean you're still reading? You're a published writer. Why would you waste your time reading?
Yeah, exactly. It's another thing they think. that we do it to get published and they don't have to read.
Yeah.
Yes, some of my favorite writers are... my favorite book this year is George Saunders' 10th of December. I think it's maybe the best book this half of this century. I mean, to me, it just doesn't get any better than what he did in that book. And by that, I mean, he's so brilliant. But I teach at a university, and I know a lot of brilliant writers. But he has all that brilliance, and then he comes behind it with this wave of love and compassion for his characters and the world. Mm. And it's so beautiful what he does. Another book that a young writer who I am crazy about is Claire Vey Watkins. She wrote a book called Battleborn. It's fantastic. She's the best new thing, in my opinion. It's my standards are really the usual suspects: Toni Morrison, Alice Munro, Don DeLillo, J.M. Coetzee. Who else do I throw in there that's not quite so top 40? Tim Winton.
Have you ever written Anthony Doerr?
Yeah, I like Anthony Doerr a lot.
Yeah,
I like his work a lot.
I
like so many writers. I just read Andre Debye's new book, which isn't out yet, called Dirty Love. It's fantastic. And I'm very excited to read Robert Boswell's new book it's big and I can't afford to start it right now, but I'm going to in a few weeks. And I also read a ton of poetry, and poetry is super influential on my work. The two poets who were at Utah when I was there were Larry Levis and Mark Strand, who are among the greatest poets who've ever lived, in my opinion. And so poetry, the compression of poets and the way poets care about the language, I try to get into my work as much as I can.
I have to ask you, do you have anything you want to toss in, add, product endorsements that you might be able to get away with?
I will say one thing, and I don't know how you'll work it in. It is a little bit of a commercial, but... I worry a little about the way creative writing is and isn't being taught at universities because of the collapse of the financial infrastructure and the privatization and the fact that Dow Chemical is never going to sponsor a really great writing program.
But you're not important like football.
Yeah. And also about kind of the whole critics versus writers mess, which there was a lot of at Utah, and now there is, anyway, to me, sometimes it takes the focus off where the focus belongs. So a good friend of mine named Karen Nelson and I started a nonprofit called Writing by Writers, and we are going to create several short-term conferences. One is just to remake the Tomales Bay Writers Conference, which was the one my graduate students and I made that the university in its wisdom canceled, even though we sold it out for 8 years in a row. it was just as a way to restart that because the community out at Tomales Bay really missed it. And we had so much fun. It's 5 days in October and six writers come. And this year we have Dorothy Allison and Ron Carlson and Carl Phillips and Fenton Johnson and Antonia Nelson and me. Anyway, it's all full up for this year, so that's not a commercial. And we're going to do one maybe in Colorado. I just want to make sure that those sort of mentoring and teaching environments exist for people who want them, because there seem to be no shortage of people who want them. And I think the low residency MFAs have done a great job picking up that slack, and I teach in one at the Pacific that I love, and I love my students there, and I love my colleagues, and it's a very good environment. So this is more like someone who doesn't want to commit $30,000 but wants to you know, have a conference experience. That,
that's wonderful.
So anyway, that's a project I'm excited about. And could really go, the kind of the sky's the limit.
I'm really curious about how you develop structure. Your books seem to not be the normal structure. And they're wonderful. I love reading them. And they flow in such a different way. How did you get there with the pieces,
yeah,
the parts?
I mean, it's related to what I said earlier. For me, like I interviewed John Irving a few years ago, which was super fun. Everyone told me it would be scary, and it wasn't. You just have to flirt with him a little, and then it's all okay. If you flirt with him a little, then it's fine. But anyway, it was so interesting because, you know, he's very adamant about how he has to know the last sentence before he starts, and how he puts this outline, which is like everything outlined right down to its, you know, sentence.
Sinclair
practically.
Lewis too.
And he puts it all up on his wall, and then he goes through it. And my first reaction to that is, well, if I had to do that, I would cut lawns for a living. I mean, I couldn't be less interested in knowing where I was going. In fact, I believe that if I knew where I was going, there'd be no reason to write it. Like, if I don't surprise myself, I'm not going to surprise the reader. But here's this great writer whose work I love, who does it exactly the way I think it can't be done. So I had to think about that for a while, and I realized that for me, my shapes and my form, I call it form because that makes me sound smarter. The form I am working with, whatever that is, be it a Rubik's Cube or a slinky tied to another slinky, moving downstairs quickly, that's my outline. You know, I don't know what the story's about, and I don't know what's going to happen to the characters. That's what he does know. But what I know is, in the case of Contents May Have Shifted, there was going to be 12 sets of 12, and that the metaphorical relationship within the 12 was going to be stronger than without the 12. So you see, it's a Rubik's Cube that's been solved. But then toward the end, I was going to start to mess it up. So it was a conscientiously unsolved Rubik's Cube, you know, and that's what makes me feel safe. Like he wouldn't say safe because he's a wrestler, but maybe that outline makes him feel safe. And for me, my idea about a Rubik's Cube or a slinky or a spirograph flower makes me feel safe.
Right.
And so that's how, like, really form is so important to me. I can't stress it enough. And if the form has logic, I worry less that the story has logic, which of course is why some people don't like me. You know, like, they don't like, they want more resolution or more whatever, but I don't believe in resolution so much. You know, I only believe in a certain amount of it. So I want the book to resolve formally as well as in terms of meaning. And they kind of, like, the resolve of the form picks up the slack if I'm not willing to say, and then it worked out all right for everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Pam, this has been spectacular. It really has been wonderful.
Well, good. And now it turns out I wasn't even on a time schedule because they're, like, still in New Mexico.
So we can mess up the house and we can start all over.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. My couch cushions will dry.
Oh, yeah. And the donkeys will go by and everybody will be happy.
I wonder where those donkeys
but
are.
Thank you so very much. And yes, we really appreciate your taking time out during an exceedingly busy moment.
Well, I have a lot of busy moments. I mean, the fact that I was here seemed auspicious. You know?
It was strange. When Sally got up this morning and saw your email, and she said, she wrote.
Oh, my God.